All right. Welcome to the Imperial Security Bureau podcast, ISB podcast for short, where we chat with leaders in cybersecurity. Today we have Keon Williams from Atlanta. He's the managing director at CLASS. It's the cyber leadership and strategy solutions firm. It's a professional services firm that supports government critical infrastructure and commercial customers. Keon's been building and managing cybersecurity and privacy programs and enterprise risk management for over 20 years. He's a LinkedIn top voice and the funniest man in cybersecurity. He's a military vet, consultant, author, speaker, board member for multiple organizations, mentor and advisor to multiple organizations. He's a great person to follow in the cybersecurity space. I'm very excited to chat with him. Welcome to the podcast, Keon.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome, sir. So I should mention, you don't have a problem with this. I've been watching you on YouTube and you actually are a great speaker. You never do this, but we have a charity. It's called the Charity. And I edit a lot of these out, but for everyone that sneaks through, we have to contribute a dollar to charity. You actually don't use any. So I'll just be editing myself, I guess.
So you're donating to charity also, or your ums, ahs, and you knows subtract from mine?
Oh, yeah. It's like cornhole. Yeah, I could do that. But yeah, it's going to be just the sum total. And we have to be called out by the audience too. They have to tell us how many.
Awesome. Well, I'll throw some in there just because I love charity. So,
Okay. Perfect. Just curious, where did the designation funniest man in cybersecurity come from?
I do a lot of public speaking. I spent years in Toastmasters honing the craft, but Toastmasters only takes you so far. After Toastmasters, I thought about doing the National Speakers Bureau so that I could continue to advance my public speaking. Person that I know who will remain nameless for this conversation, but whom I trust very much, said, Keon, you should do comedy. Because comedy and the way that a stand-up act comes together is very similar to what you would do for public speaking. There's a premise, there's a punchline, you weave everything together. I had the privilege of being in the Jeff Justice Comedy Workshop. It really did advance my public speaking. And cybersecurity is extremely boring. Having a background in comedy allows me to know where to infuse jokes, make it fun, make sure that the audience enjoys the presentation.
All right. Well, there's no joking allowed on this podcast. So just refrain if you can.
I'll be serious and limited to smiles.
There you go. Okay. Well, so I heard on the Wild West hacking pod, and this was just like 30 minutes ago, but you said you were a gamer. Just curious, what game are you playing these days?
I have been playing Overwatch since the beginning. I don't have a ton of time to do so, but I, at one point, was one of the best healers in the world.
Okay.
Now I'm trying to master the assault people, but I'm much better at healing, and I never get healed when I'm not playing a healer. It becomes an interesting level of frustration and relaxation all mixed into one experience.
That's a good character to play. It's like, I guess that's the medic in Overwatch. So a couple warm-up questions. You can probably tell I'm a Star Wars fan here. What's your favorite Star Wars movie or show and why?
I struggled thinking about what my favorite Star Wars show was. I am going to go with the original, A New Hope from 1977.
Good choice.
The reason really is, if you go back to the 70s and you think about special effects and how movies worked, that was groundbreaking, some of the things that they were able to accomplish. And then it laid the foundation for numerous movies, cartoons. I had Ewoks when I was a kid. There's all kinds of things that were the outcome of a great story and great video editing at a time where they didn't have the green screens and everything that we do now. And it lays the foundation for decades of excellence. So I'm going to go with the original.
Good choice. Yeah, you're right. It was kind of groundbreaking for that time. And some of the footage was like a painting. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but yeah, just some of the unique, like really creative special effects that they used were like, wait a minute, what? So,
and yeah, again, remember, this was the 70s. So we didn't have 8K cameras. We didn't have CGI and everything else, but right. they still told a great story that had great visuals.
Yeah, we didn't have Unreal Engine 5 at that point in time. All right, next warm-up question here. Which show was better, The Office or Parks and Rec?
The Office, hands down for me, was the better show. I had a hard time attaching to Parks and Recreation. The Office, I've seen every episode.
Nice. I like them both, but I lean more towards the Parks and Rec side. And oh, yeah, by the way, for the Star Wars thing, I'm a Rogue One Andor fan. If you haven't seen those, definitely check them out. It's the best ones that Disney was involved with. But okay, so as far as your background goes, I mean, your area of expertise, it seems on the GRC side of cybersecurity, you contributed a ton and continue to contribute regarding strategy and governance and enterprise risk. And you also spend a good bit of time mentoring young people how to get into cybersecurity. Kudos to you for that. And that's a question we'll get into later. Let's go back. I mean, what's your story? How'd you land in the profession?
Car accident. So once upon a time, a long, long time ago, given our theme, I used to unload tractor trailers for Target. My boss let me use his truck to go downtown to run an errand. When you unload tractor trailers, you show up at work at 4:30 in the morning. So I was sleepy and ran through a red light, ripped the bumper off this lady's car. Back then, we didn't have cell phones like we do now. And so I showed her where I lived. I said, whatever it takes to make you whole, I will make you whole. I will pay for it because it's not my car and I don't have any control over the insurance. She called me up, told me what it cost to fix her car. I gave her the cash. I said, ma'am, I've been working all summer saving this up for school, but I made a commitment and I will honor my commitment. And she said, because of your integrity, I have a job for you. And she plugged me in at the Georgia World Congress Center Authority. I was a cable rat, so I tied a cable to my belt and ran through the rafters and replace thin net cable with Ethernet cable so that they can go from mainframes to windows for work groups. And I did it with a good attitude. So when that project was done, I got another gig at the Congress Center. When that was done, I got another gig. Then I ended up going in the Army. And because I knew something about technology and communications, I kept gravitating to those activities. When I got out of the Army, I ended up working for the Army Reserve Command as a telecommunications specialist. When I left the Reserve Command as a contractor, one sergeant called up another sergeant and said, Keon needs a job. And that was the beginning of my career at the CDC. I spent 12 years at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And during that 12-year saga, the Federal Information Security Management Act was passed. So I went from communications to Windows System Administration to doing regulatory compliance for a federal government organization. And then when I left the CDC, I've been doing consulting and leadership and building programs around the world ever since. Car accident is the honest answer to how did I get into cybersecurity. I literally broke into it.
Yeah, you fell into it. You slammed into it. That's awesome. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned unloading trucks. I used to work for Best Buy in the inventory department. And that's there every, I think it was Wednesday and Friday. We had a truck come in, had to unload the whole thing. I was a guy that brought the TV out to your Honda Accord and said, it's not going to fit. How do you want it delivered? All right. Well, you're involved in a lot. And I'm always kind of curious about people's routines and how they manage their time. Like, how do you find time for everything that you're involved in?
I drink a lot of coffee. And my company is a real company. I have great team members who do a lot of things behind the scenes, which allows me to be the person in front of the camera, out in the public, making the magic happen. But it would be impossible for me to do everything that people see me doing if I didn't have a great team supporting activities in the background.
Tell us a little bit about your company, Class.
Class is an interesting company because it operates as a mutual fund. So I have a consulting part of the business. I have a training part of the business. I own a media company and I throw the best cybersecurity leadership conference in the world. And each one of those components of the business creates an opportunity to introduce people to other components. Some of my consulting clients started off as students. Some of my students had a great time at our conference. Some people are great relationships and great partners because I appeared on a podcast or because they saw one of my YouTube videos or a panel discussion, but everything feeds everything else. which makes it important for me to be out in the community talking to people. It makes it important to give good information away, because I'm always blessed later on by being a blessing to somebody else. But there's a lot of interweaving. I describe it as a tapestry. I've taken all these threads and woven them together, and I have a beautiful tapestry or a beautiful blanket. It serves some people, makes for good referrals to others. But being a good citizen in the cybersecurity community has produced very good outcomes across all those lines of business.
Yeah, you've got a lot of good karma coming in from all this stuff. So you have my respect. Shout out, Keon is part of a panel discussion tomorrow, Friday, March 22nd at 4:30. It's called The Future of Cybersecurity Work. I'll try to clip this real quick and get it out tomorrow for you. But can you tell us a little bit about that?
There's a great program called the 502 Project, and their objective is to bring more people into the cybersecurity profession. Some of the participants in the project are as young as high school students. The affiliation is with the University of South Florida. There's some grant money that was provided, which allows us to make this content available to everybody for free, because I get a little bit of compensation through the grant, but giving free advice to people makes it easier for them to enter the workforce. If you think about every other option, it is a training class or a degree that costs a lot of time and costs a lot of money. But most of what people know to get started is already available. They just don't know where to look. And so the 502 Project and the relationship that I have with the University of South Florida allows us to do a webinar once a month to make that webinar available to anybody who's interested. And our themes leading through the end of June are focused on the future of cybersecurity work, the future of cybersecurity controls, the future of cybersecurity technology, and then the final session that we have, and then we'll reevaluate how we're going to go forward in the second half of the year, is focused on societal change. It's a heavy topic, but a lot of sexual abuse materials are digital. And our session in July is going to focus on how do cybersecurity professionals configure existing technology to prevent the distribution of those materials on corporate networks. Most of the purveyors of those materials use their work computer to distribute the information so they don't get caught on their home computer. Or if their spouse doesn't know what's going on, it keeps their spouse out of the loop because it's in the business environment. And most business environments have much more bandwidth and much more computing power and much more storage. If we eliminate those materials in business environments, it leaves the people who are participating in what is criminal and put you in jail, even beyond the ethical issues. But if we remove the business environment as an avenue for participating in that activity, it's much harder to hide. It's easier to get caught. It makes the world a better place. And so that's how we'll end the series before people take a break for the summer.
Sad, but true. Yeah. I watched the movie Sound of Freedom recently, and it's kind of make your head spin how big the problem is. Interesting. So yeah, I'll try to plug that for you. All right. So current state of affairs here, what are the biggest challenges facing the cybersecurity industry lately?
The right word is stupidity, but the politically correct answer is lack of awareness. And there's somewhere between just plain stupid and not having awareness. Most of our problems are people don't understand what needs to be done, or there's an organizational behavior and psychology aspect where people believe, even though this is happening to everybody else, it's not going to happen to me. But my argument would be that most of our problems in cybersecurity are social and emotional, not technological. We have the controls, we have the technology, we have the standards, we have the practices. The issue is that people don't put those things into place. For example, the FBI says that business email compromise is the most expensive issue in the United States because that's what their jurisdiction is limited to. But you stop business email compromise with process. There is no reason that I should ever execute a significant financial transaction based on an order that came through an email. There should be some kind of enterprise resource planning system or some formal process so that you have checks and balances and you make sure that people aren't just stealing money. But even in my organization where we have good email filtering solutions, I see business email compromise messages every now and then where I have told myself as the owner of the company that I need to wire $5 million to pay a bill. And I say to myself, self, I really didn't send that message. Let's not click on the link. Let's not change the routing number, the accounting number. Sometimes I get messages that appear to be from my employees by name, but then you look at the email address and it has no association to the employee for doing payroll deposits. I'm in the unique position where I have awareness of business email compromise and how it works. So I pay those things no attention. I make jokes and memes out of the things and send them to my employees. But then you take your average CEO or business owner or corporate executive who doesn't know the same things that I know. Their lack of awareness puts the company at risk. And there's case after case, month after month, where people who don't know the right things perform the wrong action, and it causes harm to the organization and their stakeholders.
Yeah, my CEO texts me all the time asking me to go buy gift cards for her. I'm like, I tried to like play along for a while, and they wanted me to send pictures of the gift card rack. And I tried to send them an image off of Google, and they probably have seen that before, so they just stopped responding. But I did try to see where it went. Yeah, I mean, stuff like that is happening all the time. Is there a good catchphrase for people when they're dealing with their company emails, like when in doubt, delete it out or something like that?
we'll say that you created the catchphrase, but the best practice is to move away from email to authorize or execute financial transactions. Enterprise resource planning as a category of software can be as small as a little system like Microsoft Dynamics or as large as something like SAP that has a designated module. But real businesses should have business systems in place to support their operations. And because of the prevalence of financial fraud, even for a small mom and pop business, I would argue that you should have formal processes in place for every financial transaction. Because if I have a vendor, the vendor should fill out a form. There should be some sort of authentication to prove their identity. Ideally, the authentication would be multi-factor, so I have more confidence that it really is the right person. And only under those circumstances am I going to change the routing and the accounting number. For a very large organization that should have had an ERP system, I ended up helping a company build a security program because $25 million was stolen. And so the issue was not that resources didn't exist. The issue was that a security program wasn't in place. The organization didn't have an ERP system. They used email to manage all of their financial transactions, and hackers got into the environment. They monitored how processes worked for 90 days. And then when billing was supposed to go out, they interjected themselves into a communication and said, "Dear service provider, we've changed our financial numbers. Convert our routing and account number to this for the deposit that you're executing next week." Accounting people said, "That looks legit." They made the change. And then a month later, the real customer comes back and says, "Why haven't we received our payment?" Well, for financial fraud, if you don't claw it back within 48 hours, the money is gone.
Wow.
And so taking 30 days to realize that I sent $25 million to the wrong account, a month later, there's no way to get that money back. It becomes a huge problem.
Yeah, you hear about that stuff on the news, like, you know, sending fake invoices and fabricated PO numbers. And, you know, when you got a big company, there's a lot of bureaucracy in the finance department, and whoever is on the accounts payable side, they'd see something that looks pretty standard and it's just business as usual, you know, just pay it. So yeah, it's got to be tough to filter out the good from the bad. I do hear that companies are kind of feeling like it's impossible to prevent a breach. I mean, no amount of money can guarantee protection. So instead of continuing to invest and add to their cybersecurity team and their tools, they're just opting to buy cyber insurance instead. What's your opinion of that?
I think that is a horrible, horrible strategy. One of the reasons that cyber insurance is increasing in price is exactly what you described. People have no program in place. They're depending on the insurance company to fill gaps that the organization was responsible for. And it's causing the entire marketplace to be more expensive for everybody. And I'll tell you a story real quick. When I was in the Army, I was not an infantry person, but the mission of what I did was direct combat support. So I had to know how to do everything that the infantry did in case we encountered a situation that required infantry tactics. And one of the things that we trained on religiously was how do you respond to an ambush when you're in a caravan? So there is a prescribed approach for all of the vehicles to position themselves in a defensive alignment. There's command and control that takes place if we're taking fire because we were ambushed in a vehicle convoy. And what that highlights and why it's relevant to the conversation is that if you regularly practice response to an incident or an event, the goal is not to prevent it, because in a military situation, I can't prevent an ambush. But what I can do is I can respond to an ambush with good timing, with good coordination, so that we reduce the likelihood that somebody's going to lose their life on our team, that we respond properly to the assailant, and that we recover and then keep moving and accomplish the mission. Because usually an ambush is happening in the middle of a mission. We didn't set out to respond to an ambush. We set out to do something else that was important. And so your ability to respond, recover, reconstitute, and keep moving becomes very important in that military context. And while cybersecurity is not the same thing as military combat, the principle of respond and recover and reconstitute and continue the business mission is still valuable. And what it highlights is that I think where people are making mistakes is they put all of their effort into prevention, but then there are no resources left to respond when something gets past your defenses. If organizations invested more in their response and their recovery, NIST 800-61 is the guide for incident response. The document is free, anybody can download it, but it outlines a four-phase process that starts with planning and preparation. Organizations should document their incident response plan, their procedures, their policy that provides governance and oversight. They should practice it. What you tend to see is that people do an incident response tabletop once a year, but there are about 50 things that actually become a problem for a company. I would do incident response tabletop exercises quarterly. I would do testing monthly. And all of those things create a rhythm or muscle memory so that when a real thing happens, everybody knows exactly what to do and nobody's running around like chickens on fire trying to figure it out.
Yep, running drills. I'm surprised more companies don't do that. I mean, I think they're more reactionary. And then you have something bad happen and all of a sudden it's like, wait a minute, we got to revisit this. Like, what are we doing? And then all of a sudden it becomes important.
If you look in the news, most of the companies that have had major cyber incidents or ransomware attacks are large brands that have a lot of resources. And I have nothing to do with the planning for anybody that's been in the news recently, but it begs the question, if you're a very large chemical company that has lots of resources and your brand is a household name, what was the misstep or the thing that was overlooked that said, maybe we put a security program in place that prevents ransomware and allows us to expeditiously respond so that we don't have an outage that costs us $100 million losses in market cap? Because I can guarantee the cost to put a program in place to respond to an incident when it happens is much less than the losses that we've seen from some of the larger companies that have been breached or have had problems. And now we're back to either ignorance or willful neglect that is the root cause of why these things are happening in these large organizations that have lots of resources.
It's not just the corporate world. It's even in the government space. And, you know, you worked a long time at the CDC and probably got to see some interesting challenges there. The movie Leave the World Behind. I love talking about this movie because it scared me so much. But have you seen the movie and do you have any thoughts about that?
It's on my list, so I can't speak to it because I haven't seen it yet. But I've heard it is an outstanding movie that causes people to really think.
It is. Yeah, it is. If you haven't seen it, we won't dig into it. So just a little tech talk here. What are your go-to sources of information? What sites do you follow? Podcasts do you listen to? What do you think's the most valuable?
So this is going to sound crazy because I am more of a business person than a technical person, but I spend a lot of time on the Harvard Business School's website. They have a dedicated section for corporate law that talks about things that have happened and how governance works. I'm a subscriber for Harvard Business Review. So my top three sources are Harvard-based, but they do some very good work. NASDAQ has some great insight and information about governance of cybersecurity and AI. They hosted a fantastic presentation about ESG compliance, where you have environment, social, and governance as a regulatory obligation. So the security industry is very fired up about the SEC reporting rules for cybersecurity, but there are also reporting rules for other considerations, and ESG becomes one of those considerations. For people listening to your podcast, they probably have never heard it before, but the ESG reporting requirements provides a great template for a risk assessment that you can modify and use for cybersecurity. Because for environment, social, and governance, the issue is, what is the material harm to the organization if you have a major environmental impact that faces the organization? Because then it affects the share price. But those same kinds of considerations are relevant to cybersecurity, or they're relevant to artificial intelligence, because we're investing a lot of time, money, and resources into technologies and processes that support the operations of the business. And now you have a non-security business-focused tool that allows you to do an evaluation on the impact. It allows you to assign materiality properly. And then that concept of materiality can be spread consistently across the organization so that everybody has the same understanding about impact, regardless of what the driver is, whether it's ESG or digital transformation or AI or cybersecurity or anything else.
AI is a big topic, and you recently wrote an article. You mentioned the EU AI Act, and I'm just curious, how do you feel like AI is going to disrupt the industry?
Once upon a time, there was this thing called the cloud. And when I started off in telecommunications, the cloud was the undefined space outside your network boundary that you had no idea what was happening. So you just drew a big cloud around it and said, something's happening out there, and our information is going to go from our location to its destination. And then they took that technical concept that really was representative of ambiguity and then turned it into a marketing campaign. And now you got kids wearing capes telling everybody to the cloud. When you think about artificial intelligence, I reflect on the cloud campaigns from years ago, where nobody really understands how it works, but it becomes a marketing message that resonates with everybody. And people believed then that the cloud was going to be the solution to all their problems. And people seem to believe now that generative AI and all other forms of artificial intelligence are going to automagically cause things to happen in the business, that without it, they're going to be struggling. And the premise of my article was that for critical infrastructure, you can't have schizophrenic machines making decisions that you don't understand when your variance for industrial control systems is very narrow. For example, if you think about water treatment, there is an automated sensor that dumps the water if the pH is wrong. And so within a very small variance, if it's too basic or if it's too acidic, you just dump the water into a sump and reprocess it, because the solution to pollution is dilution. And so that's kind of the catchphrase for water treatment. But your industrial control systems are constantly measuring the water and monitoring the water and looking at the chemical properties of the water to determine, is this within acceptable boundaries before I push it out into the system that allows the public to consume it? If I used artificial intelligence and replaced that with automation to verify that everything is operating within the boundaries, there's no telling what happens and whether or not we're poisoning people, because people have taken their eye off the ball and we've put our faith 100% into automated decision-making from machine learning and artificial intelligence. And while it sounds horrible, it actually is for water treatment, but for other business activities like writing papers or generating images, who cares? Nobody's going to die if my image isn't pretty. What it comes down to is some real business analysis that says, for my company, for my industry, for a specific application, is artificial intelligence the right solution to produce outcomes that are going to be beneficial for the company? And I would argue that as awesome as AI can be, it's also not that smart. And we're not talking about iRobot, where the robots are sentient and they're running around. We're talking about something that's processing a lot of data and making a decision automatically, or presenting a consolidation of that information. And in some cases, reflecting on what happened in the past, is not as good as humans forecasting what might be the right thing in the future. And so there always requires some balance, some planning, some consideration, some strategy. And all of it works together to say, for my company, for the way that we operate, for the AI system that we're considering, is this or is this not the thing that's going to produce a good outcome?
Yeah, agreed. You shouldn't need to implement AI into everything, especially for something like water treatment. It's like, hey, it's not overcomplicated. It's black or white here. Pass, fail. So yeah, we don't need to make it any more complicated than that. A lot of times I'm upset over software as well for recruiting because these new features try to make it smarter. But actually, it just makes it harder to get the results that I want. Like, I just want something basic. Like, does it have the keyword or not? If it does, rank it higher. It doesn't need to have any more complication than that.
If we stick with your example, one of the biggest issues with artificial intelligence is bias. And so the bias that's in the system could produce harm for the individuals that are subject to automated decision making is the concept. So in the general data protection regulation, it prohibits automated decision making without human interaction. And the AI Act defines AI systems as either being high risk or low risk. And so critical infrastructure has high risk systems because it produces safety issues if the AI makes a wrong decision that causes harm to people. But even for low risk systems, you know, there has been study after study that shows that the background of the people who are feeding the machine learning models with data that then interact with the artificial intelligence solutions, they may have different ideas about what is appropriate, what's a joke, what's harmful, what's biased, what's racist. And then you have all these interactions in a global economy where our definition of appropriate in the United States might be different than the definition of appropriate in India, which has billions of people, which is then different than Nigeria, which has a bunch of people, which is different than China, that has a bunch of people. And now you have the Chinese perspective, the Indian perspective, the Nigerian perspective, and the US perspective. But all of those perspectives have the opportunity to operate in conflict with each other. Which one becomes the de facto standard for AI and machine learning that's used globally to make decisions about who's a good candidate for a specific job?
Yeah.
When you look at it on a global scale, have to consider what is the standard that's going to apply to everybody so that we have consistency. Businesses are only thinking at a micro level about the impact for their organization and the way that they use data, but impact in one organization doesn't guarantee that the impact and the outcome in another organization using the same tool is going to be positive, which now gets us back to you really have to think about and customize and tailor your decisions for your unique circumstances in your organization, given your industry and the type of data that you're processing.
Yeah, it just seems, because I did see an article about mortgages and approvals for mortgages, and the system had inherent biases, and it was like declining people of a certain race. And it's like, well, how'd you miss that? Like, how did that even happen? What isn't that? That's a basic item that you have to have it ignore, right? It cannot be biased for race, nationality, political views. So how did that even happen? And why is it so hard to filter these things out?
People have biases. Redlining is a defined concept and issue in the United States that is historical in nature, but still happens to an extent today. But specific racial groups and economic groups were prohibited from being able to move into specific areas because the people in those areas didn't want outsiders who didn't fit the mix of who was already there. But if those are the people that are programming the models that is used by AI to make decisions, well, something that I would consider horrible becomes a standard of practice in a application that's making decisions about mortgages simply based on demographics, not the ability to pay or not the credit rating or anything else. Right. I don't like somebody because they have red hair and a gray beard. And so now every red-haired, gray-bearded person is prohibited from moving into a community, not because they don't add value, but because of physical characteristics that are observable that cause them to not be qualified to move into the area because of the bias of the person that did the programming.
Yeah, fully behind that. Now, who do you trust? Americans, India, China? I guess, so is that the EU AI Act is that they're trying to lead the charge in that effort to make sure there are no biases.
Well, the EU is doing a lot. If you use GDPR as a example, that is the most influential privacy regulation globally. And the benefits of the regulation follow the citizenship of the individual. I suspect, because the law was just passed on March 13th, and so there's got to be some case law and some issues that are brought up. But what I suspect is that the way that GDPR is globally influential for privacy, the AI Act is going to be globally influential for artificial intelligence systems and what the requirements are and what people have to do. And if we focus on critical infrastructure, where I've spent a lot of time, critical infrastructure under the AI Act being defined as high risk produces requirements for vendors that are creating solutions that are used in the European Union. And so it doesn't matter if it's a company in the US that's building the critical infrastructure solution. It matters that that US made critical infrastructure solution is deployed in the European Union. And now that solution is subject to the requirements of the AI Act.
Understood. Another item you mentioned in the recent article on LinkedIn was something called Project Cerebellum. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this part of our conversation has focused on trust and good standards. And one of the things that Project Cerebellum seeks to accomplish is establishing a global accepted standard for good use and good use cases for AI. The gentleman that started the project, he and I are acquainted. He lives in Atlanta. He has a holistic information security practitioner institute. And that holistic perspective becomes something that's valuable because it focuses what are the best practices globally for the design, the implementation, the execution, and the maintenance of AI systems and the machine learning models that support them. They looked at all of the existing regulation, and then they continue to have working groups and discussions about best practices. It's a voluntary standard, but it's similar in outcome, I believe, to the FIDO Alliance. So FIDO is Fast Identity Online, and it produced a standards-based approach for us to do multi-factor authentication with hardware tokens. Given the success of the FIDO Alliance, I suspect that Project Cerebellum is going to produce similar outcomes related to AI systems. And then everybody has a winning approach for best practices to produce things that have limited bias and a lot of trustworthiness.
Interesting. I'll have to pay attention to that. So you're a strategy guy and I'm in recruiting. It's a hot topic, right? If you're building a cybersecurity team from scratch, what would your ideal team look like?
You're never going to hear this answer from anybody else, but my ideal, I'm going to lean in for dramatic effect. My ideal security team is going to have a technical writer, a data analyst, a risk management person who doesn't do cybersecurity risk management, but does enterprise risk management. And then I will sprinkle in some technical people and some cybersecurity people. The technical writer is valuable because there is a language that's used in cybersecurity that's not used anywhere else. And a technical writer is going to be able to take that language and convert it into something that is understood by everybody else. The analyst, there used to be a thing before we had artificial intelligence and digitization that was called multidimensional data analysis. So if you do statistical analysis, you might use a paid solution called Stata, S-T-A-T-A, or you might use another statistical analysis language called R. But there are tools that allow people to manually evaluate large data sets and then come to conclusions. But that ability becomes very valuable for security work when we're talking about trends and analysis and how many incidents do we have and what is our mean time to detect and remediate and what is the efficiency and effectiveness of our controls. If you have a real data scientist or statistician who can crunch the numbers and identify trends and maybe go back to statistics 101, and say what things fall within and outside of standard deviations from the mean. Now we can start focusing on outliers and ignore things that are normal based on our organization. And then the security people, you have to have security people to be on a security team. And so we can't discount them, but very few organizations think about statisticians, data scientists, and technical writers as complementary to the output that's produced, because the ultimate recipient of security information is a non-technical business person that has to make decisions about how to use the resources of the organization to produce some outcome. An outcome may be compliance, an outcome may be risk reduction, but the people really making the decisions are business people, and business people make decisions based on factual data that tells a story and justifies a direction. And you have to have those people that help tell the story properly for the technical writer and pointing in the right direction for the statistical analysis so that we know what really matters and we can focus on the right problems.
Very interesting. CISOs, if you're listening, if you need a data scientist and a technical writer for your cybersecurity team, give me a call. I will find them. Interesting take there, because you didn't just say red team, blue team, purple team. You didn't go straight into that. You had a unique answer there that I wasn't expecting. So you mentor a lot of folks how to get into cybersecurity. What advice would you give fresh graduates or any entry-level folks on how to break into cybersecurity?
There is a national initiative for cybersecurity careers and studies. The website is just, if you just Google NICCS, they have a collection of 52 work roles that specifically define the work of cybersecurity. What I tell entry-level people to do is to go through the website, look at the work roles that are organized into categories, and do your own self-assessment. In those work roles, it says, this is the work, this is what you're doing, these are the knowledge, skills, and abilities that are required, here are some of the tasks that you would do. If people graduating from school only looked at what the industry says or what Hollywood says, everybody thinks they need to be a hacker. But the fact that there are 52 distinct work roles that are organized into six categories means that, yes, we need hackers so that we can identify what the vulnerabilities are from an offensive security perspective, but you also need analysts and defenders and program managers and people to do governance. And there's a lot of work that a lot of people can do. And so that information becomes valuable for career transition people as much as it becomes valuable for people who are entering the workforce for the first time. And if an individual went to that website, looked through all the work roles and said, you know what, an all source analyst is what I really want to be. Well, now that person can take the information that's on the website, dump it into a spreadsheet, and then add a column that says beginner, intermediate, and advanced, or do a dropdown if you're a Excel ninja. But now by doing that and doing a self-assessment, the individual has the opportunity to see, hey, I have some transferable skills from things that I've done in the past. And I'm not starting from zero, maybe on a scale of 1 to 100, I know 30% of what I need to know to be successful for this career direction or path that I've selected. That adds confidence, it adds encouragement, it identifies what needs to be studied. And now we're not saying that everybody in cybersecurity needs to become a certified ethical hacker, because that's not a factual statement. We're not saying that everybody who works in cybersecurity necessarily needs to do Security Plus or CISSP, because if I've done a self-assessment and I've identified gaps in my knowledge, skills, and abilities, now I, as an individual, can go look for resources that are going to help me fill those gaps. And then I can go forward and add value in the marketplace. There are also, one of my speakers on the session that we're doing tomorrow for the future of cybersecurity work, there's a lot of bias, you know, depending on your name and whether it's male or female or considered foreign or domestic, or in some cases, just your race and your background, your nationality or your religion. There are all kinds of dumb reasons that people are going to decide a qualified candidate is not a good fit in this organization. There are some companies like CyberSN that remove all the demographic information and just focuses on skills. And so for people who are entry level, CyberSN isn't a sponsor. They don't pay me. I just think they do a great service to society because their income comes from the employers who are looking for talent. It's free to the talent to create a profile, set things up, and then be a candidate for good opportunities. And it doesn't really matter the placement firms, because there are great placement firms, whether you're using technology or automation. But the idea is that it's very valuable for the individual to know their value and know their skills and know their strengths and be able to communicate that clearly. That makes everybody's job easy. It makes the employer's job easy. It makes the placement firm's job easy. It makes the candidate's job easy, because now we're just looking for a match. I have these skills. Somebody needs these skills. Let's bring them together. And now the only question is, do we agree on the compensation and the work requirements and the environment? And is it remote or do I need to be in the office? We can focus on things that matter rather than disqualifying people for things that I think are superficial and stupid.
Agreed. It is hard to break in from a headhunter's perspective. Every time I I get a job order, the client's asking for somebody with at least mid-level experience. If you're an entry-level person, you kind of have to find other methods, right? Networking. So yeah, it is tough. And folks feel like if they get the certified ethical hacker certification or Security Plus, like that's going to make them eligible. And sometimes it won't make them eligible. And it's like heartbreaking to see folks spend money on those and then it not have the impact they thought it would. I'll have to check out the website you mentioned. Another guest suggested the cybersecurity domain map. Are you familiar with the map?
I'm not familiar with the domain map, but all those tools are similar. If I were to give specific advice to people who want to be successful in the profession, one of the best opportunities is to be part of a professional association. I used to be the president for the Information Systems Security Association on their international board. I was also a president for a local chapter. I continue to support and even sponsor chapters around the country. But what ends up happening for the Information Systems Security Association, the Cloud Security Alliance, there are a list of professional associations, you're bringing senior and junior people together. They're focusing on a topic. It's vendor neutral. Often you have employers who are in the room. You have students who are in the room. And most of your opportunities are the result of having a relationship with somebody who knows what you can do and is willing to give you an opportunity. But it's much better to have an opportunity through affiliation with a professional association and have support from a headhunter or a placement firm rather than depending exclusively on a headhunter or a placement firm, because the job candidate has to participate in his or her employment as well. Firms that specialize in placement are very good at helping individuals tailor their resume, prepare for the interview, find opportunities, but there are some things that just come down to the person. Are you a good citizen in the community? Are you donating and volunteering your time in an association on a regular basis and volunteering and helping and going to conferences? That really is a low cost, high impact component that contributes to success, especially for people who are just getting in for the first time, because most of those associations are doing educational sessions every month. And so you learn great things about how the industry really works, and then it positions you to speak knowledgeably about what you've learned when you go to an interview.
Great advice. Yep. Networking and the associations, meetup groups, there's no better way in, right? It's not who you know, it's who knows you and who can think of you whenever their company might have an entry-level role for you. So you want to be at the top of their list. So go where the community is and go hang out and make yourself known. Introduce yourself to people. Highly encourage that. Cybersecurity is a stressful job, especially if you're a CISO. If you have a leadership role, it's your job to prevent a breach, and it's hard to prevent a breach. How do you deal with the stress of the job?
I let it go when I get off of work. We already talked about the video games. It's how I relax. So I don't drink, party, or do drugs. So it leaves a few things for me to do. And so most of my time outside of work, I spend with my wife and my children. I hang out with my friends. I'm still a shooter. I'm average 90% on skeet and trap shooting.
Oh, cool.
Sometimes I go to the range, but there's all kinds of things to do. What I encourage people to think about is that who you are and what you do to pay the bills are two different things. And so I'm very active in my church, in my local community. I volunteer with things that have nothing whatsoever to do with security. And I found things that I enjoy. I actually enjoy riding my motorcycle and dragging my knee around corners at 90 miles an hour, but my wife enjoys it less. So I don't do it as much as I used to. But the moral of the story is that everybody needs to have an outlet so that when you leave work, you have the opportunity to recover and refresh and then come back with fresh eyes into the situation. I remember once we had a major cybersecurity incident when I was in charge of security at an organization, and my team was working nonstop around the clock trying to address the situation. I was the one that was running to Starbucks to get coffee or taking orders and run into a Waffle House. But the thing that people have to realize is that security is a team effort, and the team isn't limited to just the security team. If you have an incident, the entire business is involved, and distributing that stress across the entire organization doesn't cause all the stress to be placed on one person. Everybody is working together to accomplish an outcome that's beneficial for the company. So corporate culture makes a difference in how stressful or not stressful it is. Support from leadership outside of security influences how stressful or not stressful the situation is having a well-trained team adds value, because if I know that my team knows what they're doing, I can leave the office and make a Starbucks run. And then I'm able to remove myself from the situation and have some time to contemplate, hey, what's going on? Are we missing anything? You know, nobody's drowning. We're just treading water. But now everybody has the opportunity to think about, how do we work together to produce an outcome that resolves the issue, rather than everybody being deep in the weeds, struggling to breathe, and is about to drown and expire and is completely exhausted. But some of that comes from my military training. I said at the beginning of the conversation, direct combat support. But even in those cases, we find times to rest or recover, or take our mind off of what's going on, because there's only so much that you can put into something before you hit fatigue. And then fatigue leads to exhaustion. And then exhaustion causes you to be ineffective. So there's got to be some time to disconnect on a regular basis. And even in an emergency, just go take a nap and come back with fresh eyes and fresh perspective. And that tends to resolve negative situations faster.
Agreed. Good advice. Keon, I feel like if we lived in the same neighborhood, we would be like best friends, because you're mentioning breakfast at Waffle House, motorcycles, you're a gamer, shooting guns, trap shooting, going to church.
Yeah.
We would be best friends, man.
I got 90 pounds of deer in the freezer. So I,
nice.
If I had a theme song, it would be hunting and fishing and loving every day. Because I am blessed to be able to enjoy life and not let my job define who I am as a person, and love people and serve them well and have a good time.
What kind of bike do you have?
I have a Honda CBR 954. It's almost in mint condition, even though it's a 2002 model. It's never been wrecked. It's a beautiful piece of machinery, and it's in the garage under a blanket like a sleeping dragon.
Back to the cybersecurity world, derailed us there. But so what are you most excited about in the near future?
The thing that I spend most of my time on is talking to board directors about management of AI and cybersecurity risk. What I have found is that the concepts of cybersecurity are the same whether you're talking to an entry-level person that just got out of college, or somebody is on the board of directors is making decisions about the application of resources. What changes is the way that that individual interacts, because a board person is never going to hammer away at the keyboard doing what needs to be done. But whether you're at the board level or the entry level, you have to understand encryption. You have to understand multi-factor authentication. At the senior level, you're directing. At the junior level, you're executing. But MFA and encryption are MFA and encryption. And user access review is something that needs to be directed from the top and executed from the bottom, and everybody meets in the middle. And what ends up happening is that I spend more time on the strategic conversations at the top of the organization. I give good advice to people who are at the tactical part of the organization, the doers at the bottom of the organizational chart, but everybody ends up meeting in the middle, because if you get your strategy wrong or you get your tactics wrong, you're going to have a problem. And so what I'm excited about is having those conversations up and down the stack and bringing people together. I actually do almost no technical work whatsoever for customers, even though I functionally do all the technical work for my own company, but I own it and I know what I'm doing. But for people outside my company, it's really bringing all of those stakeholder groups together and getting them on the same page. And for CISOs, it's beneficial if the board and the CEO and the C-suite are engaged and understand the value that security is doing. For the senior people, not having a cyber incident adds a lot of value. There is a concept that's called a Caremark claim that was applied to an ice cream company because people died from dirty ice cream. And where that's relevant to security, there are lots of Caremark claims, and the Caremark standard was based on the courts in Delaware holding boards accountable. But there is going to come a day when people on the board of directors are personally liable for the decisions that they make about management of risk that faces the organization. And that is eventually going to drive board directors to pay attention to the cybersecurity risk that their company faces, to pay attention to the resources that are allocated, to pay attention to the risk appetite statement, including call-outs for cybersecurity and how much risk is willing to be accepted. And so the reporting rule from the SEC is the beginning of what I foresee as a long runway for changes in the marketplace that causes the CISO to not be the only person to care, but the entire organization, because all the way up to the board, those individuals are going to be personally liable for the decisions that they make. And there's no excuse to claim ignorance. The duty of care is one of the fiduciary duties of board members, is that you are properly informed about the work that you're supposed to be doing so that you're making informed decisions. And so I don't think that we're going to add a lot of CISOs to boards, but I think boards are going to start to seek education and information so that they can make informed decisions, which allows the CISO to be a great partner and have more visibility, better relationships, and more conversations at the top of the organization so that those board members can do what needs to be done for the benefit of their organizations.
If any are listening here, I feel like Kiana's built a lot of trust in that space already. So good job, man. How can people find you and learn more?
The easiest place to find me is on LinkedIn. Unless you start the invitation with, hey, I want to sell you something, I accept almost every invitation. If they say that they want to connect because they heard me say something smart on the ISB podcast, the answer is yes.
All right.
But LinkedIn is the best place to find me. I post articles. I post commentary. The only way to be a top voice is to work for LinkedIn for free and answer all their AI generated articles. And if you go to YouTube and you look up Class LLC Media, we have been in the laboratory producing about 1,000 hours of content that we already have. And I plan to start releasing that just to educate, inform, and inspire people. And there's something for everybody from entry level all the way up to board director. And some of our old stuff that's up there continues to be valuable. And those are all good places to hang out on LinkedIn, on YouTube. And if you happen to find me on Overwatch, my username is Chemical Key.
And you're a large part of the community there in the Atlanta area. So especially if you're in Atlanta, look them up.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about?
My parting shot, if it adds any value, is really the idea that you do not have to be a technical cybersecurity ninjutsu person. The profession has room for everybody from everywhere. Like, I started off as a biological and chemical weapons specialist, but I'm doing cybersecurity leadership. You know, I used to be an ISDN bridge and switch operator. I haven't touched a console in 20 years. So it's really staying connected to the trends in the marketplace, being a smart person in the room. And if I can leave people with one book, Linchpin by Seth Godin changed my life because it talked about being indispensable regardless of your position on the organizational chart. And reading that book soon after I had my first CISO gig, because I was willing to do what I had to do to add value and I didn't worry about what my title was. And it set me up to have been in security leadership for 2 decades.
Good advice. I'll have to check that book out. Jamie, you'll have to pull that up. Jamie hasn't really helped us so far in the podcast, but he will. Don't worry.
I'm sure Jamie will go back and count the ums, the you knows, and everything else. And I look forward to making my checkout to the proper charity affiliated with the podcast.
I'll let you know your tab. I think it might be $2 or something.
That works.
But it's been a pleasure, Kian, and thank you for coming on. And yeah, can't thank you enough. The second podcast. So I think it's going pretty well so far, having people like you on. So I'm very lucky.
It's like the second episode of Club Shay Shay, when you blow up and then they come back and see me that you found at the bottom of the barrel, they'd be like, see, I see where it started.
Exactly. Yep. You were a big help. Very grateful for you, sir. And if anything you need from me moving forward, you just let me know. You've created a fan in me.
Absolutely. I appreciate it.